Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 241. It is October 23rd, and we are in the sensory chapter. And it's Thursday, and on Tuesday, you had your second lecture exam. So it'd be really great if everybody were to come in and see me and look over their lecture exam, see what they got right, what they got wrong, that kind of stuff, and hopefully that will, that would help you on the next test, I'm sure. All right, so let's see, when is the next test? We don't have a lot of time. I think I tried to get it in before Thanksgiving. Ooh, way before Thanksgiving. All right, so today's the 23rd. We're going to finish up sensory, then do some endocrinology, do some muscles, and then start in the cardiovascular system looking at heart and circulation. So our next exam is November 13th, and that looks like it's going to be on a Thursday. So how many weeks away is that? It is 3 weeks away from today. Okay, so don't take too big a break over the weekend. Maybe a little break, but not too big a break. All right, and I'll try to spiff up everything in Blackboard so that you have the proper questions to look at. All right, let me turn some lights off. Anybody have any questions? No? Yeah, come take a look at your exams. And like always, there were some excellent exams and then some that weren't so excellent. I don't know what to say on average how everybody does. It's just very individualized. Okay, anybody have any questions on the sensory chapter that we've covered so far? We're looking good? Okay, we talked about what the job of a receptor is for sensation, and that is to transduce energy from one form to another. For instance, like the retina transduces light energy into action potentials. Those action potentials then are sent to the occipital lobe, and then we have the appreciation of vision. Another transducer you have is in your ear. It can vibrate when sound energy hits it, and then that converts that energy into action potentials, and then action potentials go to the occipital lobe, and you have the sense of I'm trying to trick you just to see if you're awake yet. Okay, but if you have action potentials going to the occipital lobe, what is going to be your sensation? Vision, that's right. No matter where those action potentials come from, if they come from your ear and they go to the occipital lobe, you're still going to have the sensation of vision. So action potentials from your ear should go to the temporal lobe, right? That's where the primary auditory cortex is. And when they arrive there, then you will have the sensation of hearing or sound. Right? So, and even if your eyes, if your retina sends signals to the primary auditory cortex, only action potentials, remember that's the language of the nervous system, if those action potentials from the eye go to the temporal lobe or the auditory cortex, your perception is not going to be vision, right? It's going to be hearing. Your experience, you will hear something, right? So these nerves have to be connected up to the proper locations in your cerebral cortex. And then again, the language of the nervous system is action potentials. And you should know a lot about an action potential. Like they're always the same. Same amplitude, same duration, even if the stimulus intensity changes. So let's get back talking about some kinds of receptors. We can group all receptors into two basic kinds, either tonic or phasic receptors. A tonic receptor is one that responds, it produces a constant rate of action potentials, right, as a stimulus is applied. And that rate of action potentials will not change if the stimulus intensity does not change. So if it's a constant stimulus intensity, then the frequency of action potentials is going to be the same whenever that stimulus is applied. That is a tonic receptor. As opposed to phasic receptors. The frequency of action potential changes even though the stimulus intensity does not change. So remember, the way that intensity is encoded in your nervous system is by, who can tell me, how stimulus intensity is coded for? Is the frequency of action potentials, not the amplitude, not the duration of an action potentials, but how many action potentials are there for a certain period of time, which is what we call the frequency. We call that frequency coding. All right, so for a phasic receptor, Right there, when the stimulus is initially applied, it is very sensitive. It will send a lot of action potentials to the proper location in your brain, and that will then represent what a high intensity stimulus. But if we don't change the stimulus, we keep it constant, and it is a phasic receptor, then the frequency of action potentials decreases the longer we leave that stimulus applied to that particular receptor. All right, so there are some receptors in our body that habituate a certain kind of stimulus. We call that adaptation. So even though the stimulus is still being applied to that receptor, you no longer sense it because it was a phasic receptor. Some of these receptors, like smell and touch, for instance, could you give me an example of how touch is a phasic receptor? You're experiencing it right now, as a matter of fact. Clothing, yeah, when you put your clothing on first thing in the morning, you feel it slide on, you might even feel that, oh, my t-shirt is on backwards, right? So you can feel putting your clothes on, but now you have no idea that you're wearing clothes, right? Except that you were able to get to school without problem. All right, so touch, that's a phasic kind of receptor, and smell as well is phasic. Probably when you walk into a library, any library, it kind of smells like all the books that are in there. Libraries typically have a kind of a smell to them, and after you're in the library studying for an hour or so, you don't smell the library anymore. Has anybody ever noticed that about libraries? Am I the only one? You never noticed that? Okay, yeah, check it out. Check out some libraries. Okay, so smell is a phasic receptor, right? Your smell will adapt to a constant stimulus. Okay, here is an important thing. It's called the law of specific nerve energy, and it just says that a receptor will respond best to one modality of energy, the one that it has evolved to respond to. So for instance, the retina responds to light, and the retina doesn't respond very well to other kinds of stimuli, like chemical or pressure or vibration. So light is what we call the adequate stimulus. That's the normal stimulus. But all receptors, if given a high-intensity stimulus, they can be excited, and send action potentials to the brain. And a pretty good example of that in terms of the eye, if you're hit in the head really severely and it deforms the retina, right, you will have a visual experience, right? And it has nothing to do with light, right? And what do we call that typically when you get head trauma? What do you see? You see, has it ever heard of stars? Have you seen stars, right? Okay, so that's when the retina, the shape of the retina is deformed. Those retinal cells do send action potentials to the brain. You have a visual experience, even though they're not really stars in front of you, right? Okay. But so the adequate stimulus is the type of stimulus that, when applied in a very small amount, a receptor will respond to. So, and if it's some other kind of energy, then it has to be a very high amplitude for that receptor to respond to it. Okay, we talked about these different kinds of receptors, mechanoreceptors. We're going to look at some in the ear. These respond to physical changes of the cell. When the shape of the cell changes, maybe it stretches or it bends, for instance. Pain receptors, when there's damage to tissue, it's going to send signals to your brain. Chemoreceptors are sensitive to dissolved chemicals. And give me a really good example of a chemoreceptor. Where could you have a chemoreceptor? Where do you have chemoreceptors that respond to chemicals in your environment? Nose. Yeah, and your tongue, right? Those are chemoreceptors. You also have chemoreceptors inside your body. You have no conscious idea of what's happening with them, but they measure pH, they measure glucose concentration, right? Lots of different kinds of chemicals. And then, of course, photoreceptors in the retina for light. So receptors do generate electrical events that a nerve can understand. And remember, a nerve has a threshold. And that's because there are voltage-gated channels. Voltage-gated channels start to populate on the cell membrane around the axon hillock. So a receptor will generate these graded potentials, and the amplitude of a graded potential here is directly related to stimulus intensity. As the stimulus intensity increases, right, these graded potentials increase. But since it's a receptor, we don't want to call it a graded potential, even though it is. We want to call this a generator potential. All right, so generator potential is a graded potential. It's not an action potential, but it's something that's produced by a receptor. And if the graded potential is at threshold by the time it reaches the axon hillock, then that will produce an action potential within that initial segment. So another way of thinking of generator potentials, right? Let's take a look at them. Number one, which way is the deviation? Depolarization or hyperpolarization for number one? Depolarization. What about for number two? Depolarization, just a little bit more of a depolarization. All right, and then what about three? Yeah, it's still depolarization. So how do you talk about generator potentials that are always excitatory or that are excitatory, right? Do you agree with me that depolarization is excitatory? Yeah, okay. So how do we talk about excitatory generator potentials? We call them EPSPs. So generator potentials are really the equivalent of EPSPs in other parts of the nervous system, right? And these are produced by an adequate stimulus under normal circumstances. Okay, so there's generator potentials. So now you know something about graded potentials, generator potentials, action potentials, and one more. What's another kind of potential that's really important? Maybe a couple more. How about resting membrane potential? What about threshold potential? Yeah, you're familiar with all of those things. All right, so like I said, generator potentials are directly related to stimulus intensity, and then after a threshold is reached, the frequency of action potentials then is directly related to stimulus intensity or the intensity or amplitude of a generator potential. The only thing else that you should remember is that phasic receptors will adapt to a stimulus, and then your perception of that stimulus will decrease over time, even though the stimulus is not going away. So let's think. Would pain be a kind of receptor, or would it be beneficial to have pain receptors operate as phasic receptors? So think about that. And so what does that mean, a phasic receptor? That it's going to become less and less and less sensitive to a stimulus. Would it be good to have pain receptors that become less and less sensitive over time, even though it's still a damaging stimulus? And the answer is no. You always want to be aware of that damaging stimulus so that you can remove your body from it, right? So pain receptors are tonic receptors. They are not phasic receptors. Okay, tonic receptors, the generator potential does not adapt to a constant stimulus strength. So here we have a slide of three different kinds of stimuli. They're on for the same period of time, or they're applied for the same period of time, but the intensity or the amplitude of the stimulus changes. So here is the first stimulus. It's a low-level stimulus. It does produce generator potentials, right? But what can you tell me about these generated potentials with regard to a neuron or the axon within a neuron? These generator potentials do not reach threshold, right? So this does not send any signals to the brain. So your perception is nothing, even though there's a very low level of stimulus there. Your brain has no idea it's there because the generator potentials haven't reached threshold and no action potentials are being sent to the brain for your appreciation. All right. If the intensity is increased, left on for that same period of time, notice that the generator potentials are higher in amplitude and now they have reached threshold, or at least part of the time they have reached threshold. And since they're threshold, then nerves that carry action potentials to the brain do generate action potentials and they do go to the brain, you do have an appreciation of this stimulus. Right? But these action potentials are pretty far apart. The frequency is very low. What could you tell me about that stimulus or your appreciation of that stimulus when these action potentials are far apart or if the frequency is very slow? Okay. That just means that the intensity of the stimulus is very low. Right, because frequency is directly related to the signal strength or the stimulus strength. Right. We're going to go back and take a look at that in just a second. Let's look at this third circumstance. The duration of the stimulus is exactly the same, but it looks like now it's twice what it was in the second condition. right? And we said that generator potentials are directly related to stimulus intensity. So now these generator potentials go way past threshold, right? And there's very significant depolarization, maybe even goes positive a little bit, okay? And then they start to decrease after the stimulus is removed, and we can see that the frequency of action potentials increases compared to the second condition, right? So if I were just to show you a train of action potentials, like the case A that I'm circling right now with action potentials far apart compared to B, where action potentials are close together, I could ask you which one of these represents a stronger stimulus. And you could tell me, not by looking at the height of the action potential or duration, but by the frequency of them, right? So this is what your brain would hear. If it's a low-level stimulus, your brain would hear a blip, blip, blip. If it's a high-intensity stimulus, then your brain will hear blip, 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 right? The same, like the same amplitude, just more in a certain period of time. Okay. We call that frequency coding. Last time, I think we talked about some differences between general sensation and special sensation. And, well, let's just see if you guys remember any of that, or even if I talked about it, but I think I did. What is a special sense? Special sense. Okay. It has to do with receptors, how many you have of them, and where they are located. Right. So a special sense is due to a receptor that is only located in one or maybe two locations in your body, and that's it. They're not located all over the place. And they're usually a fairly complicated organ that's responsible for generator potentials. So the special senses would be, well, I'm going to ask you, what would be good to taste? How about a sugar cube? You know what sugar tastes like. If you take a sugar cube and put it on your earlobe, can you taste it? No. Your belly button? No. Kneecap? Can't taste it. You have to put that sugar cube on your tongue, right? And that's the only place where you have the sensation of taste. And so that qualifies for a special sense. And all the other organs that work that same way, like smell, which we call olfaction, and vision, and hearing, and some senses for equilibrium, those are all special senses because they're only generated in one or two locations of your body. And you can be tricked a little bit because here's a sense that is very interesting to consider, and that is proprioception. Is proprioception a special sense or a general sense? You guys know what proprioception is? We talk about it in anatomy a little bit. We haven't talked about the receptors in physiology yet, so I'm not quite sure if you can remember what proprioception is, but proprioceptors can sense muscle tension and deformation of a joint capsule, so it can tell body position. Proprioception gives you an idea of where your body is. If you're upside down, laying down, if your hand is over your head, behind your back, even without looking. So proprioception, a special or a general sense? General. And wow, I thought I could trick you guys. Why is it a general sense? Yeah, because every muscle in your body has these sensory receptors. Every tendon does. Every joint capsule does. And, of course, those are located all over your body. So it is a general sense. Okay. In terms of special senses, of course, there can be exteroreceptors or interoceptors. Intro just means inside your body that respond to things that are happening inside your body. Extro means that you have receptors that somehow communicate with the environment and can be sensitive to things that are happening in your environment. External environment. All right, so the first special sense we're going to look at is called gustation. And of course, gustation is the sense of taste. And you know, of course, you taste on your tongue. And because your tongue has structures that we call taste buds. All right, so if you go home and stick your tongue out and go, ah, and look at your tongue in the mirror, can you see taste buds? You see. You see the surface of your tongue, is it flat and smooth? It is not flat and smooth, but you see little bumps on there right? Those are not taste buds. Those are what we call papillae. All right, so these little projections are almost like a villus within the small intestine. They're very small, they're hard to see, but they're still not taste buds. Right? Each of those papillae can have hundreds of taste buds associated with them or embedded in a papillae. So taste buds are this thing that we're looking at right here. And I can see that there's a taste cell, and then that there are some support cells or epithelial cells around them. And would you be able to see these cells with your naked eye? No. What do you need to see a cell? A microscope, right? So this is a microscopic structure. A taste bud is a microscopic structure, and you have hundreds of these things on each of the papillae. We can't even see a papillae right here because it's too big. It would maybe a papillae would fill up the whole room right here. Okay, so here is a taste bud. It's got receptor cells, and there are some taste hairs on this apical part of the taste cell, and it's buried within the papillae, but there is a pore that allows material, saliva, and compounds that are dissolved in saliva to enter this taste bud and interact with these taste hairs. Generally, we think of taste as being composed of sweet, sour, salt, bitter, and umami, which is a sensation of fullness, right? So when you eat something that is satisfying, we would call that the umami sense. So how many are there? One, two, three, four, and five. Five individual senses. And so you might be wondering, well, how can I taste everything that I know I can taste with just these five sensations? So maybe we should think of something that is composed. Actually, you can appreciate each one of these things individually. Right, to understand how your tongue works. So what would be a good example of something that is maybe salty and sweet and bitter and very fulfilling at the same time? What would be a good example? Anybody give me a good example that I might want to use in my next lecture?
Peanut butter.
Yep, it's salted. Okay. How about a margarita? Anybody, you guys probably have never had a margarita. Maybe some have. So when you have a margarita, what do you taste? Salty, tastes sweet. Yeah, sour, you taste all of those things. And by the proportion of those different tastes, as a matter of fact, you probably all are experienced, and I probably couldn't trick you. Right? If I gave you a margarita, you could tell exactly what it was by the combination of sweet, sour, right, and all of that stuff. So every taste bud has about 100 of, the papillae has about 100 of these taste buds. So let's look at a molecular level how these taste buds work. So here is a good exam figure for you. So here is a taste cell. Here are some taste hairs coming off. There are receptors on the taste hairs. And when you stimulate a cell, what is your general understanding of when a cell is stimulated? What happens to it? It says right here, it is depolarized, right? That's how we usually excite cells. So this is for salty and sour. So what is the chemical compound salt? What is it made out of?
Sodium.
Yeah, we haven't talked about it, but probably a lot of you know. It is just sodium and chloride. It is salt, table salt. Okay, and when you put salt in solution, what happens to sodium and chloride? They dissociate into sodium ions and chloride ions, right? And of course, sodium is a cation. So for a receptor that can sense salt, they just have channels in these taste hairs. So when the concentration of sodium increases in your mouth, when you have salt, it will diffuse through this channel inside the cell. And what do you know about sodium entering a cell? Is that inhibitory, excitatory, or nothing? It is excitatory, right? So when sodium enters its cell, it depolarizes. That depolarization will move down to this more basal region and will open calcium channels. When calcium floods inside the cell, and you know that calcium inside this cytosol is usually what? Almost zero. It's very, very low. So when calcium comes in, that's the signal to have these synaptic vesicles filled with neurotransmitter move to the cell membrane, fuse to the membrane, and release neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft over here, thus communicating with the neuron right after it. All right, so For salt, it's just a real simple ion channel. And I would guess it's really easy to appreciate that now in this course, right? That's a very simple kind of channel. Sour, right, has to do with the amount of acid in something that you've eaten or drunk. And what is acid? What is pH related to? Hydrogen ion concentration. Hydrogen ion is, well, it's an ion. What kind of ion is it? It's a cation. So for taste cells that can detect sour or acid, there, again, is just a simple ion channel. When the hydrogen ion concentration increases, then that hydrogen ion will diffuse through this channel into the cell. And then what happens to the, how would we describe the electrical event inside this cell? It depolarizes, right? Because when a positive charge enters, it depolarizes. And when it depolarizes, pretty much just like the sodium taste cell over here, right? Calcium channels open that causes fusion of the synaptic vesicles and release of neurotransmitter, which then communicates with this more distal neuron, and action potentials then are sent to the brain. So salty and sour, just simple ion channels for sodium and for hydrogen ions. All right, well, we got three more. The remaining senses don't have simple ion channels, but they have G-protein coupled receptors. So here is a really nice example. I know a lot of you are really hungry to get a good example of what good a G-protein receptor is. Here is a really couple really good examples. Okay, so here is a sugar compound. So we're going to talk about sweet and umami. Umami is usually triggered by amino acids of some kind. And so let's just consider sweet and or sugar. So here you have a sugar, and it binds to a G-protein. Now, does that sugar molecule enter the cell, just like sodium and the hydrogen ion in the two previous cases, if it's a G-protein? No, it's outside the cell. So the sugar we're going to consider, what? That's a, what is that? What is that? What is the sugar here outside the cell? It's going to trigger some kind of response inside the cell, but it is always outside. That is the, yeah, first messenger, right? First messenger. So with G-protein coupled receptors, we always think in terms of first messenger, second messenger. The sugar is the first messenger, is always outside the cell. But when it binds to the G-protein coupled receptor, it activates the G-protein. And that G-protein can maybe activate an enzyme that converts ATP into cyclic AMP. So cyclic AMP levels increase inside the cell. And cyclic AMP is always inside the cell, so what would we want to consider that? The second messenger, right. So the second messenger concentration is directly related to the concentration of first messenger outside the cell via this G-protein coupled receptor. Okay, and then that second messenger will bump into some, and we're aware of this already, can bump into a channel, and in this particular case, it's going to close a potassium channel that's normally open. All right, so let's think. If a potassium channel is normally open, what's the effect of the membrane potential when potassium leaves? Yeah, it's going to hyperpolarize, right? It's going to hyperpolarize because potassium is a positive charge. But if those channels now close, what happens? If it can't hyperpolarize because the positive charge can't leave, then potassium accumulates that, decreases the electrical charge inside the cell, and what do we call when you decrease the membrane potential? Okay, when it goes back to zero is maybe a better way of saying it. If it becomes less negative, that is, that's depolarization, right? When you close a potassium channel, that is causes depolarization, and you know that to be excitatory or inhibitory depolarization. That's excitatory, right? So when these ligands bind to these G-protein coupled receptors, that causes depolarization via these potassium channels, which we haven't really looked at specifically. Here's a nice specific example. And that causes fusion and docking of these synaptic vesicles, release of excitatory neurotransmitter on the sensory neuron, and it then ends up in your taste centers in your brain, all right, G-protein coupled receptors. The last one is bitter. And a good example of a bitter compound would be quinine. I think you can buy this in like tonic water. It has a bitter taste. And Again, it's not an ion channel, but it's a G-protein coupled receptor. Quinine binds, so quinine is the first messenger, right? And then that produces a second messenger, and that second messenger will go not to the plasma membrane, but to smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And what were some of the functions of smooth endoplasmic reticulum that we had to be aware of? It's for lipid synthesis, but something else too. Lipid synthesis is like a standard thing we think about, but we shouldn't forget about calcium. Yeah, it stores calcium, right? Calcium ions in particular. So the second messenger opens up calcium channels, and then calcium just moves out of the smooth endoplasmic reticulum down a concentration gradient. And that calcium then is used, or is the signal for the fusion and docking of these synaptic vesicles and release of excitatory neurotransmitter on this receptor neuron, or this sensory neuron. Okay, so there are a couple of different schemes. Some are just strictly ion channels. That's really a simple way of doing it. Others require G-protein coupled receptors, so the tastant molecule doesn't enter the cell, right? And it works through a second messenger that is produced inside the cell by the G-protein. So that is gustation. All right, so in order to taste something, it has to be in your mouth. You can't taste something at a distance. I know some people are saying, well, you can smell things, that chemicals that aren't in your nose, maybe you can taste things that aren't in your mouth, but we don't really think that is true. Okay, smell. That's a sense of olfaction. Here is a nice sagittal section of somebody's nasal cavity. You're probably familiar with these bones. Like, what bone is this right here, where I have the cursor? Can you remember what that is? Yes, you can. Yes, it's the frontal bone. There's a frontal paranasal sinus right here. And then over here, what bone is this back here? Well, that might be hard to tell. That's your sphenoid bone. And then between frontal and sphenoid, we got this one here. That is your ethmoid bone. Yeah, ethmoid. Some of you that take an anatomy with me know that's my favorite bone in the skull because it does so many things, including gives you the sense of smell, because in this cribriform plate, there are olfactory nerves that go through the olfactory foramina into your nasal cavity. And this is the only place that I know of where you actually have part of your nervous system dangling outside your body, right? And we find that in the nasal cavity. And as a result, these neurons don't live a very long period of time because they're subjected to anything that you're breathing in your environment, right? But you do need them for the sensation of smell. All right, so let's take a little bit closer look. So here's that cribriform plate with a number of olfactory foramina in it. Here we see some of the olfactory receptor neurons here and here and here. It's embedded within an epithelium. Some of these epithelial cells are stem cells. And these neurons only live for, maybe 2 weeks, something like that, because they have a rough life. They're not really inside your body. All right, and those stem cells replace these neurons, and they kind of look like bipolar neurons. And I think that's noteworthy because one of the things we learned in the nervous system is that your body doesn't produce new neurons, right, typically. But here is an exception to that rule. New neurons are produced by stem cells within the nasal epithelium right here. So that's pretty interesting that maybe someday somebody could figure out how to take some of these stem cells from your nose and maybe rebuild your spinal cord, right? Because these cells are stem cells and can regenerate different kinds of tissues, nervous tissues in your body. So that would be cool. But what might be a side effect of that? Maybe you start smelling with your back or something. I'm not sure how to think about that. That's kind of a silly comment. But yeah, go ahead. They have started doing that. Oh, they have. Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah, you could email me a reference or something if you can remember where that was. Well, I just pulled that out of the air. I didn't really think that was true. So that was hypothesis on my part, and maybe it's more advanced than that. That's really cool. Okay. So remember, these more specialized cells like neurons are derived from stem cells. Stem cells can produce other kinds of functional cells in your body, not just one kind. All right, so these receptor cells all work through G-protein coupled receptors. Right, I don't have any other protein, other nice pictures for you to look at, but these receptor cells, the smell hair cells or the projections are down over here, and a odorant molecule has to bind to a receptor, and these are all G protein coupled receptors, and there are hundreds or maybe thousands of different kinds of G protein coupled receptors responsible for different kinds of odorant molecules. So the sense of smell is a whole lot more complicated than the sense of taste. Okay. I think that's all I would like to say about the olfactory system. All right, ears and hearing. And we're going to talk about vision last. So when we talk about the ears, the inner ear, there are actually three senses that we're going to pay attention to. It seems like there should only be one, but there are three. And one that everybody's familiar with is what special senses involved with your ears? Hearing, yeah, exactly right, hearing. But there are two more that have to do with equilibrium so that you can maintain your balance. There are receptors that can sense linear acceleration, and there's another set that can sense angular acceleration. Now, what the heck is that? What is acceleration? That's not something that we would expect you to know in a biology class necessarily. Physics class, yeah, but what is acceleration? Okay. What do you have in your car that can tell you how fast you're going? That's a speedometer, right? And that speedometer will tell you what? A distance per time. How many miles per hour, right? So that will tell you speed or velocity, but that's not acceleration. What is acceleration? It's a change in speed or velocity, right? And we don't have any accelerometers in our car, typically. But we do in our ear. We can tell when we're speeding up or slowing down in our car because we have these accelerometers in our inner ear. And the ones for linear acceleration are what we call static equilibrium, but we also have some that are responsible for angular acceleration. And a good way to think of angular acceleration is spinning, right? But not at a constant rate, but when you either start spinning or stop spinning, these are the ones that are operational. Right, so you got hearing, static equilibrium, and, oh, I didn't tell you the last one, for spinning is kinetic equilibrium, kinetic. So there are three important senses. So sometimes when somebody has a severe ear infection, right, not only does it affect your hearing, it can also affect your equilibrium, how you can maintain body posture, especially when you're moving. Okay, and that equilibrium is oriented with respect to gravity, which is always pulling down. All right, so here is the inner ear, and the inner ear is inside the temporal bone, and there is something that's called a bony labyrinth. Here is the bony labyrinth inside the temporal bone. This thing that looks like a snail, probably from anatomy, you recognize that to be the cochlea. The cochlea, or the organs inside the cochlea, are responsible for the sense of hearing. Right? And then the rest of this, right here, sometimes we call this the vestibular apparatus. Vestibular apparatus. It's continuous with the cochlea, but it has different sense organs in it. And the outer part of it is bony, so that's again, what we would call the bony labyrinth. We can break this down into two areas. This big kind of bulbous area here, that's what we call the vestibule. And then we see some of these really small canals that loop off the vestibule. And these are what we call semicircular canals. And it looks really interesting because there are three of them. And what can you tell me about spatial dimensions? How many spatial dimensions are there that we live in? Yeah, and don't consider time because that's not a spatial dimension. But there are three, right? How can you move? You can move forward and backwards, up and down, right and left. And if you know those three, you know everything about how you are moving, right? Those three dimensions. So there are three semicircular canals. These are responsible for detecting the change in your spinning or angular acceleration. So we're going to look and see how that is, right? So it has these three important senses. The vestibule has a space that has an organ within it that's called the utricle. There's another one that is the saccule. These are responsible for linear acceleration. Right? And there are different organs within the semicircular canals that we call the crista ampullaris. And I'll go over those again a couple times. Oh, I didn't switch this over. Sorry, you guys are twisting your head just to see one screen. But that's, uh-oh. I can't get to it without closing this program. Okay, I'll show you in a little bit. Okay, so this is the bony labyrinth. Let's do this. Okay, remind me next time that I'm not showing it on both projectors. Okay. All right, so this is within a certain region of the temporal bone. And probably you should know what region that is. Can anybody remember what region of the temporal bone you have this bony labyrinth? It's between the external acoustic meatus and internal acoustic meatus, which I can't point to. That is the petrous region within the temporal bone. Is that ringing a bell maybe to some people, petrous region? Okay. Within the bony labyrinth, there is a membranous labyrinth. So here's the membranous labyrinth inside the cochlea. Here's the membranous labyrinth inside the vestibule and the semicircular canals. So there is a tissue lining, and inside that lining there is fluid. Sometimes that fluid is called endolymph. In different parts it's called perilymph if it's surrounding some of these tubes. And that soft tissue contains the organs for these different senses. So I can see the utricle and saccule here, and I can see the crista ampullaris, but within this little bulge at the base of the semicircular canals. And that's what we call does anybody remember? Oh, I just remember what it's called. This little bulge right here, it's called the ampule of a semicircular canal. Is that ringing a bell for anybody? Ampule. Ampule is what? Just a tiny little vial. Sometimes we put medicine in there, made out of glass. You got to crack the top of the glass open to get the medication out. That's an ampule. So that's what these little swellings look like to somebody. And you have three organs for changes in spinning from the semicircular canals. Okay, so linear acceleration, we talked about angular acceleration within the three planes. Okay, let's talk about the equilibrium senses. Well, let's focus on equilibrium senses for linear acceleration and angular acceleration. Within the membranous labyrinth of the vestibule and semicircular canals, there are certain kinds of cells, and these are like epithelial cells that have these cilia poking off of them. But these are what we call stereocilia. They're different than a usual cilium. Remember, most cilia are responsible for motility. So these have something to do with motility or bending, but they don't make the environment swim around. They don't swim around in an environment. But if the environment moves over them, they do bend, right? So if the environment is moving, they do bend. For instance, like that endolymph that I talked about, endolymph is surrounding these cilia or stereocilia, so they can bend. And depending on which way they bend and how far they bend, right, they can produce different generator potentials, which then can produce more or less action potentials in the sensory neuron. So if they, in this particular case, if they bend to the left, right, then that is excitatory. We see a lot of action potentials being generated. If the stereocilia bend to the right, then the production of action potentials is inhibited. So depending on how the cell membrane deforms, then the cell can either depolarize or hyperpolarize as a result of just manipulating the shape of the cell, at least at the level of these stereocilia. And the one cilium that's most responsible for that is the kinocilium. This is the one that produces generator potentials. Okay, so depending on how these bend. So what kind of receptor would this be? Would this be a chemoreceptor? Or a photoreceptor? Or a mechanoreceptor? That's just a nice simple mechanoreceptor, right? When the cell changes shape, it's going to change electrical properties of the cell. So it's going to change the ion channels in these different stereocilia. So how can we use this? Well, you're going to see that your body uses this for the sense of hearing, static equilibrium, and kinetic equilibrium. All right, vestibular apparatus. I don't think I want to talk about anything on this slide just yet, or I did. Okay, so the utricle and saccule are in the vestibule. Right, that's between the cochlea and the semicircular canals. And both of these are maculae, and we have two of them. I'll show you what one looks like. Here is one, macula. And I see that here is a basement membrane, and here is a hair cell that has the stereocilia poking straight up. I see a number of hair cells, and it's poking up into something that is like gelatin. It's like a gelatinous mass, and embedded in this gelatinous mass, and on top of it are little crystals, little rocks of calcium carbonate. These are what we call otoliths. Because when you hear that term odo, what would you always want to think of? Ear, right? Like an otoscope is an instrument somebody would use to look in your ear. So odo refers to ear. So these otoliths have mass, and so they respond to gravity. In this particular case, gravity is pulling straight down right on the top of these stereocilia and is not bending them one way or the other. So that is not really a proper stimulus for these hair cells when somebody is straight, nice and erect, looking straight forward. But if somebody bends their head forward, right, look what happens to the maculae. Now these otoliths start to pull that gelatinous mass down, and that deforms, right, the stereocilia, and that deformation of these cells can change the rate of action potentials to the brain, which your brain then, in this particular case, can understand to be a change in linear velocity or linear acceleration. Okay. So I guess I wanted to ask you a question. How would you think about acceleration in your car? If you look at your speedometer and you just see 60 miles an hour, what is your acceleration? And you look at it again and it's 60. And then you look at it again. What is your acceleration? It is zero, right? It's zero. But if you look at your speedometer and you're going 5 miles an hour, and a couple seconds later you're going 10 miles an hour, a couple seconds later than that you're going 60 miles an hour, what do we call that? That is a change in velocity. That is acceleration, right? So there has to be a change in velocity. And gravity acts as a change, and it acts like a change in, it acts as an acceleration or a change in velocity. Okay, so you have two of these oriented in two different ways so that you can tell if you're accelerating vertically or horizontally. So the utricle is important for horizontal acceleration, and the saccule responds to vertical acceleration. So you have two of these systems. All right, so remember, acceleration is a change in velocity, not a constant velocity. The semicircular canals, on the other hand, remember there are three of them for each plane, spatial plane, and here is the ampule. Inside the ampule we have something called the crista ampullaris, and I think I'm just going to look at a crista ampullaris, so we're going to zoom way into, really in tight to this ampule right here, and this is what a crista ampullaris looks like. And it's filled with endolymph as well, right, inside the membranous labyrinth. And I can see some epithelial cells. And what do these cells look like? They kind of look gold to me, but what do they remind you of? These are hair cells, just like in the maculae. And these hair cells project up into something we call the cupula, and the cupula is a gelatinous mass as well, right? And it can deform, it can bend, depending on whether the endolymph is going to push on it one way or the other. So how does that endolymph push on the gelatinous mass, right? And when the gelatinous mass deforms, it moves the stereocilia one way or the other, and that changes the rate of action potentials of those sensory neurons going to the brain. So how is it that that gelatinous mass can be deformed by endolymph? Well, when somebody is staying absolutely still, right, then this fluid, endolymph, is stationary. It's not moving. Right? If you're just standing still, nothing is moving. But there is, since it's mass, it has a property of inertia. And does anybody know anything about inertia? What does inertia mean? We all kind of have a sense of what it means. But what is inertia when it comes to... What has inertia? Mass has inertia, which means what? Inertia means that if something is stationary, right, it likes to remain stationary. It doesn't like to change its velocity. It doesn't like to accelerate. Right? But the reverse of that is true. If something is in motion, it likes to stay in motion. It doesn't like to stop. That's what inertia means. Right? If it's stopped, mass likes to stay at a certain location, but if it's moving, it likes to keep moving in that direction and with that particular velocity. That's what inertia means. Yeah, it's resistance to change in velocity, and it's a resistance to get moving, inertia. So sometimes maybe you have to start a project like studying or something, and you have to overcome that inertia of what? Wanting to just stay stationary. Okay. But once you get going, it's a lot easier. Okay. Okay, so what's a good way to demonstrate inertia? Okay, well, I got something here maybe I can demonstrate with. Maybe. Yeah, I can. All right, so what do we got? We've got the hair cells, and we got endolymph. And I have a piece of cardboard right here in my Coke bottle. And let's see, which one is going to be which? This is going to represent endolymph, and the Coke bottle is going to represent hair cells. Okay, so if there's no change in spinning or linear acceleration, okay, then that endolymph inside the semicircular canals is just stationary. So if it's stationary, can it push or pull on the hair cell if you're just being stationary? It can't, right? All right, but now let's just say you start to spin, and probably you guys did this over the weekend, right? Did you stand still, all of a sudden start spinning and stop suddenly? All right, and then so what happened to your vision when you stopped suddenly after spinning a while? It starts spinning around, right? Okay, so what is that due to? It's due to that endolymph. When you start spinning, the endolymph is stationary. And here is the hair cell. See, is this analogy going to work? You know what? This right here is going to represent endolymph. And this is going to represent the hair cells. Okay? So when you start moving, the hair cells are attached to your body, so they're going to move. A hair cell is going to move. And this is the fluid, the endolymph. So if your body starts moving, all right, and the hair cells start to move, what about the endolymph inside your ear? Is it going to want to move along with your body? The answer is not immediately, because it has inertia. So endolymph will want to stay still. But your body is going to move, endolymph is going to stay still, and you could practice this coming up. What can I do to kind of prove that? I could move this fluid, the body, but the endolymph is going to stay still by just doing what? Ooh, this is a really thick piece of paper. Can I try it? I can do like that. Ooh, almost. Okay, with practice, I could get, okay, you could move your body, but the endolymph is going to stay still. So if your body is moving, if your hair cells are moving, but the endolymph is stationary, then that endolymph is going to push on the capsula in one direction, right? So if the endolymph is stationary and you start to move the crista ampullaris, then the endolymph is going to push on that capsula. But what about when you stop spinning? All right, so you started spinning and you stayed spinning for a certain period of time. So eventually the endolymph catches up with you, right, has overcome that inertia. So now endolymph is spinning the same way your body is spinning, and then you stop. All right, what is the other property of inertia? Once you get going, it's hard to stop. So now the hair cell has stopped moving, but the endolymph is still spinning around inside the semicircular canal. So now endolymph is going to push the other direction on the hair cell. So let's demonstrate inertia in that sense. Right? So we got inertia, so I'm going to start out slow, and I'm going to stop all of a sudden. And what's going to happen to the Coke bottle here? Is it going to stop just as sudden as the cardboard piece of paper? And the answer is no, it's going to continue moving because it has inertia. Let's see if I can do that. Oh, fell over. Lousy piece of paper. Okay, let me try it again this way. Just falls over. Rat. Oh, give me a piece of paper. I don't know if you'll get this back. Okay. All right, so I'll start with the first one here. Okay, so if I go like that, it's easy, right? This right here had inertia. It didn't want to move. Like, for instance, when you start spinning, Now, after you spin for a long period of time and the endolymph catches up to you and then you stop all of a sudden, let's see what happens. Oh, it still falls over. All right, I need to drink about half of this Coke in a hurry. And what would I want to show you? That when I stop, the Coke bottle should slide over the piece of paper. Can I get it to do that just a little bit? No, it wants to tip over. Does anybody have a bottle that's like half open, half full? I could pour it out, but I'm too cheap to pour it out. Yeah, let's try that. Is that glass? No? That means you could throw it? Thank you. All right, so just to show you guys, first experiment works. No trickery there. What about here? Ah, okay. So that shows mass likes to keep going, right? It's difficult to start, but it's also difficult to stop. That's what your endolymph does. Can I keep this? Just kidding. Okay, pass that back. So that's the job of the semicircular canals. So the utricle and saccule for linear acceleration, semicircular canals for angular acceleration. And so since you have three of them, three semicircular canals oriented in three dimensions, you can tell in any which way that you're spinning, even at an angle, because your brain will be able to add up the three different components to figure out exactly in what direction you're spinning. Just like when you have taste, right? Your brain can add together all those primary sensations to figure out what kind of food you are actually eating. All right, so let's finish this up by looking at ears and hearing. Ears can sense sound waves, right? So sound waves travel in all directions from its source. And so what is a source for sound waves? A sound wave is a physical wave. It's a pressure that varies high and low. And so it's a mechanical kind of wave. It's not like light. Light is an electromagnetic wave. It's not mechanical. And as a matter of fact, if you were to look at a loudspeaker that can reproduce low frequencies and put your hand on the loudspeaker, and if you're playing music with a lot of bass in it, what's going to happen to your hand? It's going to move back and forth. So it's a physical wave, right? So you need mechanoreceptors for that. And that wave is measured different ways we can characterize it. Certainly the intensity is the loudness or what the amplitude is of a wave, and the frequency is how many amplitudes or how many peaks occur in a certain period of time. Maybe I'll just draw this out really fast. How would we show a wave? So here's a wave. How would we show that this wave right here with less intensity? All right, it's going to look something like that. All right, so here is the amplitude of that wave. So this has higher intensity compared to this one. What about frequency? Low frequency, right? The wavelength is large, okay? And high frequency, and let's draw it maybe with the same amplitude. Here is high frequency. Same amplitude, same signal strength, just a different frequency. And your ear can tell these things apart, low frequency and high frequency. That's really kind of amazing that it can do that. That intensity we measure in decibels, maybe you'll test your hearing in lab. All right, so let's review just a little bit of some anatomy of the ear. Remember, there are three divisions of the ear. There's the outer, there's the middle, and the inner ear. We've been talking about the inner ear exclusively so far. I see the vestibule and semicircular canals. And here's that external acoustic meatus. The auricle helps funnel sound energy into the external acoustic meatus. And since it is a physical wave, it will vibrate this tympanic membrane back and forth. And you have some special sweat glands in this external auditory meatus that make sure that this tympanic membrane doesn't get dried out and crack. What do we call that stuff? Anybody know? Or what's the name of that kind of sweat gland? It's a ceruminous gland that secretes cerumen or earwax. I think probably you ran into that in anatomy, right? And that helps moisturize this tympanic membrane, so it's going to vibrate back and forth. And in the inner ear, we have some auditory ossicles. There are three bones. Remember, every time you hear osseo or osteo, you should think of bones. and they're pretty small. I've got all three right here between my fingertips, and guess what? You couldn't disagree with me because they're so small they would be completely hidden, right? That's how small they are. And they vibrate because they're attached to the tympanic membrane. They carry that vibration over to the vestibule where there's another membrane, right, that vibrates back and forth. And so now you have sound energy within the endolymph of the bony labyrinth inside the inner ear. So now you have sound energy. And we said that's a fluid, endolymph. And so you might be wondering, why do you have this apparatus of all these bones and the tympanic membrane and the oval window right here? Tympanic membrane is very large. The oval window is very small. And consider this. Maybe some of you have experienced this, maybe not. Maybe you were swimming someplace and somebody's talking to you and your head is above water, and then all of a sudden you put your head below water and that person still keeps talking to you. Now, what can you tell me about your sensation of that person that's talking to you? Can you hear them? You can't really hear them, right? Even though they're still talking to you, and that's because it's difficult for sound energy to enter a fluid environment. It's just difficult for that to happen. And so this apparatus here, the tympanic membrane, the auditory ossicles, is just a really fancy special way that allows sound energy that's in air in your external acoustic meatus to enter the watery environment of your inner ear. It sort of acts like an amplifier, but not quite. And that's because the properties of air and water are just enough different to where sound doesn't want to go into water very easily. Okay, so here is that cochlea. We said that's responsible for hearing. And it looks like a snail, but it's something that's all coiled up. And if we unravel it, if we uncoil it, it's going to look like this. All right, so here is a cochlea that's just now in a straight line. Here's that tympanic membrane that we talked about. So sound energy vibrates the tympanic membrane, which will vibrate the malleus, incus, and stapes. The stapes is attached to the oval window, which vibrates back and forth, which puts then sound energy into the cochlea. So that's just a special little apparatus. So why is the cochlea all wound up like that? Why is it wound up like this? Because, right, the cochlea is acting like a piano. And if you play a note on one end of a piano, you hear a certain frequency. If you play a key on the other side of the piano, will it play the same note? It's going to be a different note, right? On one side, it is low frequency. On the other side, it's high frequency. And in the middle are mid-range type frequencies, okay? So think of the cochlea as a piano, and the reason why it's all rolled up is because if it wasn't rolled up, it would be sticking out of your head. You would have like two pianos coming out of your ears, right? So evolution has figured out a way to roll it up to make sure those pianos are still there, but they're in a nice small space. All right, so just like a piano, which when you hit different keys produces different sounds, can anybody describe to me why a piano produces different sounds, high frequencies and low frequencies? Maybe probably some of you have looked at a piano. Yeah. Yeah, the tensions of the wires matters. And two other things matter besides tension. It's the thickness of the wire and the length of the wire as well. So the thicker the wire and the longer it is, then the lower the frequency that it produces. So if you want a really high frequency, what does the wire have to be like? It's got to be really thin and short, and it will produce a high frequency. Okay. So just based on the size and shape, right, certain materials will like to vibrate at a particular frequency. And the cochlea has different sizes and shapes to it as well. The thickest part of the cochlea is the center. And the thinnest part is this place over here that's closest to the middle ear. So the place that's closest to the middle ear, since it's the smallest and thinnest, this is the one that will vibrate at high frequencies. The thickest part of the cochlea over here will vibrate only at low frequencies. So depending on what frequencies enter, right, then they will excite different parts of this. Well, we're going to talk about the organ right here. All right, so just think of this as just like being a cochlea, and here you can see what the distribution of frequencies is, right? So 500 hertz is a lot lower than 2,000 hertz. Hertz is just a cycle per second, or from peak to peak on a wave like that. So 500 is a lot less than 2,000, and 20,000 is what? A lot higher frequency than at 2. So high frequencies can actually go across the membrane and enter this chamber, and then that pressure is released by the round window. That's important, because if energy enters the cochlea and it has no place to escape, then it's going to damage the cochlea. Right? Something has to absorb that energy, but the round window just releases that energy. So that doesn't happen. So when low frequencies enter the ear, this part here sends action potentials, and that goes to the primary auditory cortex, and your primary auditory cortex is arranged just like a piano as well. So if you stimulate one part of the brain, you hear a low frequency, and if you move over far enough and stimulate that part of the brain, it's going to hear a high frequency. So you have pianos in your ears, you've got pianos in your brain, and that's one way that you can appreciate different tones. And if you hear three different tones with the proper distance between those tones, then of course that forms a chord. Right? So you can appreciate music as well. All right, so let's look. Oh, I guess I got to define a couple things about this chamber that we're looking at. All right, so we got three chambers. We've got the scala vestibuli right here. This is how sound energy enters. Right, and then here is the scala tympani down over here. And the scala vestibuli and tympani have a fluid that we call perilymph. There's an inner chamber that we call the cochlear duct. And the cochlear duct also has fluid in it that we call endolymph. Right, so it's all three of these chambers have fluid filled with them. And sound, depending on the shape of the cochlear duct, can take a shortcut across to get into the scala tympani. And then released by the round window. Let's see what we have here. Let's make a cross section of the scala vestibuli, tympani, and the cochlear duct. And that's what we see right here. Right? So here was that top chamber, here is that bottom chamber, here is the cochlear duct filled with endolymph. And within the cochlear duct, we have these structures. And it's kind of hard to see what's going on here, so let's zoom into this region right here. So we're inside the cochlear duct. And what do we see? Well, I see some cells that have like these stereocilia on them. What would you want to call these cells right here? They're hair cells, just like the hair cells in the macule and maculae and the crista ampullaris. And you can see that the stereocilia project up into something that we call the tectorial membrane. And the tectorial membrane is almost like that gelatinous mass. It can wiggle around, it can vibrate, and depending on its size and shape, it will vibrate either at high frequencies or low frequencies. And when it vibrates, you can see that it's going to bend the stereocilia on these cells. These are mechanoreceptors. And since they're mechanoreceptors, depending on the bending of the stereocilia, it will change the electrical properties of this receptor cell. It can depolarize or hyperpolarize them, which then can increase or decrease excitatory neurotransmitter on this sensory neuron. Right, which you guys know is the vestibulocochlear nerve, right? So cochlea means coming from the cochlea, the vestibular division for equilibrium comes from the vestibule. Okay, so what do I want to show you now? Well, I want to stop this and show, and I think I want to do something like this. So let's take a look at, I hope I didn't close it down. I didn't. Good. Okay, so here is a synopsis of what we've been looking at. So here's a table of structures and functions of special senses of the labyrinth, right? So the labyrinth is just meaning the bony labyrinth for static equilibrium, kinetic equilibrium, and hearing. And of course, you know that to be in the petrous region of the temporal bone. So how many senses are there? Just a number. Are there one, five, there are three, right? There are three senses. Where's my cursor? I lost my cursor. There it is. Okay, so there are three. And they are, of course, hearing. There is static equilibrium, which measures linear acceleration. There is kinetic equilibrium that measures angular acceleration. All right, so this I have in Blackboard for you to print out. I don't have it in the slides for you, but it's a special little download, and it probably looks like a Microsoft Word document. So for these three senses, we would like to know, is the external ear necessary for each of these three senses? So for hearing, is the external ear important for hearing? Okay, like if you plug up your, I don't even want to do that because I can't talk, but if you plug up your external acoustic meatus with something, can you hear? You can't, because sound energy can't enter your ear. So external ear, yes. What about for static and kinetic equilibrium? Couldn't care less if you have an external ear. Couldn't care less if you have a middle ear either, right? Because all those hair cells are in your inner ear. So for hearing, external and middle ear are definitely important, as well as inner ear. But for the senses of equilibrium, the only thing that matters is your inner ear, because that's where those sensory receptors are, within the vestibule and the semicircular canals. So what is the bony labyrinth for each of these senses? Well, for hearing, we just said it was the cochlea. For static equilibrium was the vestibule. And for circular acceleration or kinetic equilibrium, those are the semicircular canals. Right, but that's not really what generates electrical impulses to your brain. It is some other structures within the bony labyrinth. And the lining of the bony labyrinth is what we call the membranous labyrinth. Right, so inside the cochlea, you have the cochlear duct. Inside the vestibule, you've got the utricle and saccule. And in the semicircular canals, you have semicircular ducts. So what are the receptor organs then for these senses? Well, the organ of Corti for hearing, the maculae for linear acceleration, and the crista ampullaris for angular acceleration. And what are these organs made up of? They have receptor cells. And what are the receptor cells for hearing and static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium? Who could tell me what the receptor cells are? They're all hair, are you kidding me? A hair cell for all three of these different kinds of sensations? And the answer is yes. All right, but depending on how these hair cells are put together with, for instance, the cupula or gelatinous mass with the otoliths or the tectorial membrane, you have three different special senses inside the ear. So this one kind of receptor cell has been adapted to what, three way different kinds of senses in your body. All right, so here's a really good chart for you to break down some of the anatomy so that you can appreciate the physiology inside the ear. Okay, so this right here, this is the organ of Corti. I didn't point that out. Okay, so we talked about smell, taste, hearing, two kinds of equilibrium, but we said that there are six senses, which means that the thing that's left is vision. Let's see if I can say anything about vision. Okay, of course, vision is a special sense because you can only see with your eyes. And what is it that you see with your eyes? You see light, and light is not a physical wave like sound. It's an electromagnetic wave. What do you have to know about that? Not very much at all. Okay. But depending, well, so here is what we call a spectrum, and a spectrum is just something that is labeled according to the frequency of a wave. So very high frequency waves are what we call gamma rays, and X-rays are pretty high frequency, very, very high frequencies, ultraviolet. And then here we have the visible light spectrum. You could actually call this a rainbow. Rainbow is just a spectrum of visible light, things that we can see with our eye. And within this spectrum right here, there are different kinds of frequencies. And the different frequencies then represent to us different kinds of colors. So the frequency of light, right, will produce different colors in our vision. And you can see, well, I can't see at all what these are. But I would guess that this is blue over here. Okay, Indigo. No, blue indigo. So I can't tell. This looks like red over here. Is that red? Okay. Well, it all depends on the frequency. And then even slower frequency, electromagnetic radiation like infrared, microwaves, radio waves, these are way below the visible light spectrum. Oh, I know what I was thinking about. So there's a way you can memorize. I could actually think that, I could tell you guys that I actually know this. So here's red, here's orange, here's yellow, right, here's green, blue, indigo, and violet. How's that? Yeah, so because it's supposed that is just represented by somebody's fake name, Roy G. Biv, right? So each of these colors have a different frequency, but that also means they have a little bit different energy. There's low energy with red, there's high energy with this with violet, and as a matter of fact, if you get into ultraviolet, that's even higher energy, X-rays, higher energy still. So as the frequency increases, the energy of a particular wave will increase as well. Okay, let's look at the structure of the eye. Here is the iris. And here's the pupil. So remember, the pupil, in terms of anatomy, maybe some of you haven't thought of this, but what is the pupil? What is the pupil? What's the function of the pupil? Pupil, it's a function. I'm glad I'm kind of mentioning this. The pupil is a hole in the iris. What do we call a hole in anatomy? A hole in anatomy? Y'all know. A hole in anatomy is a foramen. Right, so the pupil really is a foramen, and what's the purpose of function of a foramen is a passageway for something, like a blood vessel or a nerve, right? And in this particular case, right, the passageway is for light. It's not for nerve, but it is for light. And as the pupil diameter increases, more light can enter the eye, and as it gets smaller, less light can enter. So we call that constriction or dilation. That's the job of the iris, right? It's to adjust the amount of light that reaches your retina. So in dim light, well, I tell you what, let's talk about the structure just a little bit. The iris has two kinds of muscles. There are muscles that are circular, which I see right here, and then there are muscles that are radial, that poke out like this. And the radial muscles right here are stimulated by the sympathetic nervous system. The circular muscles are stimulated by the parasympathetic nervous system. So pupil dilation and constriction are, of course, antagonistic to each other, and they rely on those two different divisions of the nervous system. So in dim light, what happens is that the pupil dilates to let more light inside the eye, and what contracts there are the radial fibers, right? So the radial fibers under sympathetic stimulation open the iris or dilate the pupil. But in bright light, right, the sympathetic nervous system no longer causes dilation, but the parasympathetic nervous system will stimulate these circular fibers to constrict. So you could actually think of this as like an orbicularis muscle, like orbicularis oculi or orbicularis oris. When they contract, they close your eye, close your mouth. But in this case, these circular fibers close the pupil. So the pupil is not really a structure. It's really just a hole through something, right? It's really just a foramen. And what passes through there is light. All right, so pupil dilation or constriction controlled by either the sympathetic or parasympathetic nervous system, and you should be able to relate which fibers in the eye are being stimulated, right, and under what conditions, what nervous system is operating and under what conditions as well. All right, I think next time we're going to talk about accommodation. And accommodation is due to another muscle, but it's due to a ciliary muscle, not necessarily your iris. Maybe look up and see what accommodation means. Sign-in sheet is going around.